And tonight, crystal skulls. But first, let me tell you this story. Ethiopian scientists say they have discovered hominid fossil fragments dating now between 3.5 million and 3.8 million years ago in what could fill a crucial gap in the understanding of human evolution. Ethiopian archaeologist Yohannes Haile Selassie said the find included several complete jaws and one partial skeleton and were unearthed in the desert near where the famous fossil skeleton known as Lucy was found in 1974. And in a moment, we're going to talk about crystal skulls. There are 13 crystal skulls known in the world at this time. Max, apparently, is the largest, weighing about 16 pounds. And many, including the British Museum, consider Max to be one of the rarest artifacts ever found on the planet. Estimated by some to be 3,000 to 10,000 years old, Max was found in a tomb in St. Augustine, Guatemala, between 1924 and 1926. He was used by the Mayan priests, apparently, for healing and prayer. In a moment, our guest, Joanne Parks, who has Max on Coast to Coast AM. Joanne Parks, in search of anything that would help her 12-year-old daughter, I'm going to have her tell you this story, who is dying of bone cancer. Their family doctor introduced Joanne to Norbushan, a powerful healer of the Tibetan sect of the Red Hat Lamas, who had just returned from Guatemala to study with Mayan priests. It was here that the Lama came into the presence of Max, a mysterious crystal skull. Chen was given this precious artifact when he left the Mayan so he could use it in his journey as a healer. Joanne ended up working for the Lama for many years, and before he died, he gave the cherished crystal skull to her. No explanation, but that someday they would know what the crystal skull was all about. Our guest tonight at Coast to Coast, Joanne Parks. Hi, Joanne. Welcome to the program.
Hi, George. How are you?
Good. It's been a couple of years since you were. I think you were on with Art. Back in July of
95, I think.
Yeah. My gosh, how time flies by.
I know, when you're having fun.
You got it. And you have had fun. You've been busy, haven't you?
I have been on one wonderful 20-year adventure. I have had Max. My husband and I, we have owned Max, or been his keeper, caretaker. We've had him for 30 years. In 20 of those 30 years, I have shared him with the world nationally and internationally.
Do you keep him in a box, or do you keep him out where he
he has his Max room now.
He's got his own place.
He's got his own pad. Yeah. People come from all over the world to sit and meditate with him. He's a very, very different crystal, as we'll go into.
Yeah. We'll get into that and crystals and their abilities as well. Now, tell us a little bit more about this story, though, about your daughter and what
happened.
It's
a very long story, and you always start out by asking, you know, because I was clueless. This was not part of my life. I was raised here in Houston, just mainstream religion, minding my own business, didn't need a crystal skull, never heard of crystal skulls, didn't even need a crystal. And our daughter had been diagnosed. We met the healer through our family medical doctor in 1973 when our daughter had been diagnosed with bone cancer. And, of course, she was only given 3 months to live with really absolutely no hope for survival.
Yeah, you were at your wit's end.
I was where?
You were at your wit's end. You had nothing to do.
I was at my wit's end, yes, absolutely. And we learned that he had studied a very, very, very early form of Tibetan Buddhism. He was an American. And he studied to be a Red Hat, and he was infused with ancient Tibetan shamanistic practices. He studied the Red Hat ways, and that's the way of the Dung Path way, and that is an ancient combination of Tibetan and Chinese healing modalities for energy work that go back thousands of years. And, of course, we knew nothing about that, and my husband went over there to do cabinet work, and of course our doctor had called us and asked my husband. He was in the custom furniture business at the time.
Okay.
And he said, you know, he didn't want to call him a llama because he knew all llamas just had four legs, and he was not going to try to explain it. So he said, I have this doctor that I rented a house to. Would you go over and look at the cabinets? He said, yes. So my husband came back and said, you know, that's this very strange little fellow over there. He walks around in a bunch of capes and gowns. Well, you know, me raised this mainstream religion, and I thought, bunch of capes and gowns. And so I told him, you know, don't go back over there. That guy's in a bunch of woo-woo for sure. You know, he'll turn you a lizard, put you in a pot. And he said, no, I committed. And I said, okay, you be the lizard, not me. So, you know, the the synchronicities, you know, there's no mistakes, I feel. It's just synchronicities.
I agree with that.
I was upstairs with running water, and I knew our daughter didn't have but a few months to live, and he picks up this magazine. The magazine was over 30 years, is now over 30 years old. And it said, Lama Norbu Chin, America Tibetan's Healer. So he hollers up and says, oh, I know who our strange little fellow is. And I said, yeah. I said, you know, I couldn't hear him much. He said, he's this famous red hat Lama. And, of course, I said, you know, he's a red hot what? You know. And no, he hollered back and forth. No, he's not a red hot nothing. He's a red hat Lama. And I thought to myself, I asked him, I said, you know, I hollered down. I said, you mean he's a four-legged animal? He said, no, he's a two-legged man. I said, no, the only llamas I know have four legs. He said, no, this one has two. So I envisioned this little four-legged animal running around with a red hat on his head, healing people.
Yeah.
You know, I thought he lost it. So, no, he says, come down. So he shows me the book, and I found out that he was a famous healer. Well, of course, I wanted to meet him. And I told him about our daughter, and he said, well, you already gave her chemotherapy. He said, but we'll do our best.
Did you want to meet him with your daughter in mind? I mean, were you thinking, hey, we've tried everything else?
Yes, okay. Absolutely, with our daughter in mind. So I said, okay. I said, we're going to meet him. I said, he was a famous healer. And then I read about him. I'll tell you about his work. And he said, well, you already gave her chemotherapy. He said, but we'll do our best. So I just say through the Lama's work, the Creator's work, the monks, the skull's work, they did extend her life for 3 more years. That was written about in the Tibetan papers. I ended up there with them for many more years after that, watching him and the other monks do their healing work. And this is where the skull sat on their altar.
Now, did you work with him or volunteer?
I worked down just mainly answering the phone, watching them do their healing work, bringing the people to be healed, not even knowing why. And I found out that he was discovered and backed by our 14th Apollo astronaut, Edgar Mitchell, who was the 6th man to walk on the moon.
I know Edgar quite well, mm-hmm. too.
And the late Doris Duke of Duke University, the late actor Yul Brynner,
mm-hmm.
Harry Saltzman, who was famous for the James Bond productions, other notable people that you would know, and then 6 chiropractors and some medical doctors that did understand what healing work was. But he was just way, way too early for his time. Way too early. He wanted to be a healer. He was also an undercover agent. He was a DEA agent. He went into military early. He went into the Marines. He went into Special Forces. And he agreed to be placed into prison where he helped break up some serious drug rings. And while I've got
undercover.
Undercover. He went in, he went into university schools and prisons. And he went into prison to help break up some serious drug rings. And while he was in there, he smuggled out information that ruined the political career of Lieutenant Governor for corruption within the system. But he was found out, and contracts was placed on his life. He was paroled out of the system, placed in the Federal Witness Protection Program. He moved around under many aliases. So, you know, he said, well, this is probably about the time I should do my healing work. Well, he met a woman by the name of Madame Alexandra David Neal. And she was well known for her studies in Tibet and Nepal.
All right.
And she was the first European woman who could move freely in and out of Tibet and Nepal for 14 years. And she was so engrossed with him, but what he could say and what he knew and what he wanted to do, that he felt he had lived a Tibetan life, that she gave him a letter of introduction to what they call the Red Hat Gompa. And that was a monastery, and he went to India and Kathmandu, and he said, he told us he's sat over there waiting for his lama until he thought he'd starve to death. And he had this letter, and he went over and handed it to this little monk, and this monk says, where you been so long? And this monk said, and Norbu says, well, I've been standing across the street looking at you. Why didn't you come get me? He says, no. He said, life is a learning lesson. You learn through initiation and experience. We tell you nothing. So he says, you were supposed to come to me. So he said, okay. And he said, here's the letter. So he took him to his lama. He went to India, Kathmandu, and he stayed in a little Asian nation called Sikkim. And that's where he entered there and spent 3.5 years studying under what they call a Geelong and a teacher priest. And he was placed in a cave there with a small window, naked, cold, fed through a little hole in the wall.
How long did he have to stay in there?
He stayed in there about 9 months.
9 months?
9 months, and fed through a hole in the wall. And every 2 or 3 days, when they put the food in, if they took it out and the food was still on the tray, they knew the monk was dead.
What was supposed to happen?
Well, that's where he sat and learned and meditated. That's where he stayed in there, and that's where he sat and learned and meditated. And he had to either meditate properly, progress to the next level, or just go mad or die.
I would go crazy.
Yep. He had to hold hot coals in his hands without burning his hands, and he had to cut arteries, allowing them to bleed in the bulb and mentally stop the bleeding or die. They took him out, placed him in ice-cold rivers, wrapped him in cold blankets or ice blankets. He had to regulate his body temperature or die, and he passed those tests and was given title of a gila.
I mean, did they monitor him, Joanne?
They didn't monitor him. They just stuck him in that cave. And that's how they do. He was a bond. And this is their shamanistic practice.
My God. If he died, he died, right?
You died and you died. They did documentaries on the bonds on TV, and they write about them. And he went into the Philippines. He wanted to know all of the healing modalities. He went into the Philippines to see the Filipino healers. He went into on a drug assignment into Central America. He wanted to know about the medicines. He knew that the medicines was in the plants. And he met the shamans and the medicine men, he said. And he said he worked with him for a while, and he said the skull was given to him. He came back to Houston. He started a healing foundation, and that's where he placed the skull in this altar, and they used it as their healing and their spiritual tool. And they used to chant and talk Tibetan to it, claim they communicated with it. And I didn't know anything about energy or how high the energy was coming off of this crystal skull. And they would tap that energy and focus it into the meridian and acupuncture points of the patient's body to assist in the healing. So I knew they revered it, but I didn't know anything about it. I'd go home, and my husband said, well, what did the monks do today? And I said, well, the crazy monks talk to a rock. You know, the crazy monks talk to a rock. But, you know.
Well, your husband doesn't sound like he was a believer.
Well,
at that point.
I was just there, and I watched him. He extended our daughter's life. I was there. I watched him do the healing work. It wasn't that I wasn't a believer. I just didn't understand. You know, and oftentimes people are afraid of things that they don't understand. So I didn't understand what they were doing. I just knew they were talking to the rock, and they were healing people, and they were doing their work. And, of course, we had other lamas there, and one lama was straight out of Tibet, and I didn't know he was a high lama. He was called Choji Lama. And his name was known all over Tibet like the Dalai Lama. And he was found by a man named Dundal Sarong. And Sarong came from high nobility of Tibet. He worked as a high official in the house of the Dalai Lama for 27 years. In fact, Dundal Sarong's father was the commander general of Tibet.
All right.
So he came from a high political family. And he walked in this little backstreet restaurant, and he saw this high lama back there cooking and washing dishes. And he didn't, you know, he escaped in 59. He didn't know the language.
Mm-hmm.
He took what he could to make a living. And he recognized us being a high lama. So we went over there, and he started talking Tibetan to him, and he threw his arms around each other, and he brought him to the foundation where we were, and he escaped with ancient Tibetan books. And so they were always practicing. He always took a liking to me, and I couldn't understand why. I'd go in there, and I would think, you know, that's his name. So I'd just wave at him and say, hey, Choji, hey, Choji. Well, that wasn't his name. That was his title. But he would grin and bow, and he would always come to the healing, the office. He'd come to bring me to the healing room, and I couldn't understand why.
Sounds like Yoda, almost.
I don't understand it. I didn't understand it at all. But I go down there, and after, you know, I didn't understand what an honor and a privilege this was to wait after all of these people die. And really, when you start listening to this and you see all the synchronicities that came together like a book or a pattern or something, it just blows my mind. So I go down in the healing room, and I'm grinning, and he's grinning, and I thought, well, you know, I don't have anything to fear this guy. He, you know, he grins and bows and backs away. So I looked to see what he was doing, and he had different plants and stuff in there, and I didn't know that's how they made their medicines. And I come home, and my husband said, well, what went on today? I said, well, the monks showed me a bunch of weeds in a cup, a bunch of grass and stuff. So he says, what do you mean they're showing you a bunch of grass? I said, well, it looks like a bunch of grass to me, but it was their plants. They were making their medicines and their ointments. And he would come and get me. I mean, this is all. I had a 20-year-long adventure, but this is my learning experience. And these are the things that I thought about and went through.
Did you learn by osmosis, Joanne, because you were there, or were you studying?
I didn't study at all. No, through my psychic, I looked at it and I watched it, and I guess I was just taking this all in and not knowing what I was even looking at, but it was going into my subconscious and unconscious mind. But I watched him do this. He would come get me and take me to the kitchen, and he was making me these little Tibetan hamburgers. Oh, this is all.
What's a Tibetan hamburger?
I didn't know either, and I didn't know that Tibetans didn't eat meat, so I don't know what I ate today. But I tell you one thing. They were some spicy meatballs. So this kitchen was in a square.
Were they made out of plants?
I don't know. I thought they were meat or something, and he would come get them. They were hot.
I'm not sure I want to know what they were.
Well, they didn't. They were hot. I'd put them in my purse, see, and I'd come home and try to give them the dog. No, the dog didn't want them, but he would do this all the time.
Dog wouldn't want them.
Yeah, he came in here and he gave me these little plates of hamburgers, and he would wait till I eat one. When you go, I'd put them in first.
What did it do for you after you ate the thing?
Well, nothing. They were just really hot and spicy.
I mean, it didn't give you any special powers or anything?
They were just some of their food that they ate, like rice and stuff would go with it.
Okay.
So I'd go in there, and the kitchen was in a square, and he was flipping these little hamburgers, and they had a cat and didn't sweep the floor, so he and I and the cat was watching these little hamburgers flip. And one day, one flipped in the floor. So he just picked it up and put it back in the pan, and neither he nor the cat or I missed a beat. We just kept watching the hamburgers flip up and down, and he handed them to me. And all I could think, oh, my gosh, which one just went into all the cat hair? So, you know, this was my training, my learning. I didn't even know what was going on, and I walked out, and listen, I never heard of acupuncture needles. Didn't know what they were.
Okay, so while all this is going on then, explain again how the crystal skull came to be with him.
They came to be with Norbu?
Yeah.
Well, again, he went down there on a drug assignment. And he went in there because he wanted to know the medicines. He wanted to know the ointments. He wanted to know what the shaman.
And they gave this to him.
They gave this to him. He said after, I don't know if he worked on them, if he helped them or what they did.
It was a gift.
It was a gift.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now Max is what, 16 pounds?
He weighs 18 pounds and 2 ounces.
All right. How big is he, I guess?
He's just a little larger than a human head size.
Okay.
And the pictures do not do him justice, and we'll talk about the science of him.
Okay.
But anyway, the llama would do acupuncture on me. I didn't know what they were doing, and I found out that this was a high llama.
Was the skull always near anything he did in terms of practice?
The skull was in the healing room. The skull was not, when people came in to go through their healing, they would not touch the skull because Norbu did not want to take away from what he was doing.
How important was the skull to what he was doing?
I think it was very important because they would chant to it and talk to it, and they would talk to it in the mornings and the evenings. And when each person came in there, they would touch that energy. They would touch that skull, and that's when they would touch the patient, starting at the top of the head.
So my impression then is the skull somehow gave the llama the power, the energy to do whatever he did.
Well, I think his healing modalities was already there, and I think that he had the ability with or without the skull. But I believe the skull, because of the energy, expanded on what he did.
Okay.
Enhanced it.
Okay. And in your best history now, you've been with the skull for years.
Yes.
Is it something of, I guess, if one would say it's heavenly, is that what it is? I mean, does it give off?
Well, Max is mystical and magical, and you know he's got magnetism. It has an energy field that I didn't know anything about.
It's not negative by any means, is it?
Well, I don't know anyone he's killed yet.
No.
Not negative. Everyone gets a good feeling off of Max, and of course it does depend on a person's levels of growth and understanding.
How'd we get the name Max?
He gave himself his name. I brought him home before the llama died. He gave it to us, and his parting words were, he could have just given it to the other monks, but I'll tell you, I know why. But his parting words were, he said, take care of this, and one of these days you'll know what it's for and what it's about. Well, we really didn't. We knew it was their heating tool, so we brought it home and we put it in a box in the closet for almost 10 years. I thought it was laying around there minding its own business, but it wasn't. It was minding mine because it would come to me in dreams. I would dream this would come to me in dreams, and it was always telling me that I needed to find this particular person, this particular man. And, I mean, can you imagine going to your closet and hearing this in your head?
In your head.
That you haven't found this particular man and that he was important to mankind.
Let's pick up that story when we come right back, Joanne. From the closet. Max is in the closet for 10 years. Okay, so Max, the crystal skull, after 10 years, sort of comes out of the closet. And we'll be back in a moment with our guest, Joanne Parks, on Coast to Coast AM. We're going to get into the story with Max and the crystal skull and Joanne, but later on tonight, we're going to talk about the powers of these crystal skulls, how they were made, why they were made. So, Joanne, Max is in the closet. You've got him in the closet for 10 years.
He's in the closet, yes.
And then he starts coming out again.
Well, he kept telling me to find this particular person. So in June of 1987, here's where all the synchronicities start.
Okay.
In June of 1987, I turned on a TV show, Good Morning Houston. there's another skull looking at me. And all I could say, it could have been a different hour, a different day, a different minute, and he might still be in the box in the closet.
Mm-hmm.
And this other skull's looking at me. So all I could think is, oh, my gosh, another talking rock. So I go call the station, and I wasn't going to tell him about my talking rock.
It's Max's brother, right? That's,
I guess it was. I thought if there was more, they were all supposed to look alike, and if they, you know, they didn't look like mine. So I called him and said, would you have those people call me? I have something that looks like that, but it's not like that. So they called back, and they started laughing. They said, no, lady, these are museum pieces. You probably got plastic or glass. This is before the museums found out that what they had were contemporary. He said, you've got plastic or glass. Said, well, it was given to me by a monk, and it came from Central America. Because, see, Max came from Guatemala, but it's no telling where he actually originated.
Exactly.
From.
He may have ended up there.
Right. These were not actually Mayan, Aztec, or Native American artifacts. They are pre. They're not Aztec or Native American and never have been. The Mayans did not create and wouldn't use some crystal, so these go pre. So I told him, I said, he came from there, so it will be right there. So they come out, I pulled the poor old skull, at that time skull, out of the box, and they started laughing at each other and poking at each other. They just said, look what she's got in a box in the closet. And they looked at me and said, you don't know what you have, do you? I said, well, if I did, I wouldn't have called you, would I? He said, well, these are so rare, and we don't know much about them, how they're made. He said, but you really got a rare one, and I didn't know what they were talking about. He said, but there's no researchers, so we said, take it to the Houston Museum. So I boxed him back up, and the next day I took him to the Houston Museum. They opened up the box, and they said, oh, yeah, you got something rare there. I heard that yesterday. He said, but you got something real rare. He said, we don't know how they're made, where they come from, or even any researchers. He said, let's put it on display.
How do they know they're rare? Like
because there was only a few of them found. So, and then they didn't particularly know how they were made. But they said, you have a real rare one. And I had no idea what they were talking about. So I said, no, you know, you don't know what he is, and I don't know what he is. I said, it don't seem quite right yet to put him on display. So I boxed him back up. I brought him back home. I opened up the closet. I put him back in there, opened up the box, and I pat him on the head. And I said, well, one of these days, Skull, I'll find this man you're looking for. And then just psychically in my head, loudly and clear, he said, by the way, my name is not Skull. My name is Max. I jumped up and I looked at him. I said, holy moly, I got a rock in a box in the closet. He has a name. And I could hear him say, you have to call that station back. And I kept arguing. I said, no, I'm going to put you downstairs in the other closet. But he says, but I'll find you there. So I said, I knew you'd say that. I called the station back. I said, well, I didn't learn anything newer at the museum than I learned from you. So they said, we'll give you the name of one more man. That was Mr. F.R. Nick Nocerino of Northern California. So I said, okay, I'll give it a shot. So I called him, and I said, Mr. Nocerino, but he said, what? I said, uh-oh, he sounds pretty grouchy. Never mind, forget it. I didn't have nothing to say. But he said, no, you call me for something. And I says, no, never mind. He says, no, he says, don't hang up. What did you call me for? I really didn't want to tell him.
Yeah.
So I said, you know, I got this crystal skull. And I said, kind of, you know, I was looking around. There's nobody here in my house. I said, I got this crystal skull, but he got quiet. He said, you got what? I said, never mind, forget it. You think I'm nuts. Never mind. He says, oh, no, don't hang up. Describe it. And I thought, describe it? I said, it's a rock with a face on it. And he says, no, describe it. And I looked at him. I said, it's a rock with a face on it. And I said, it's got two hollow eyes, and I said, a hollow nose, a bunch of teeth, no hair, and it's got this white cap on the side of its head. It's got a bar mitzvah hat on the side of its head. He said, you got the skull with a white cap? And I looked at
him. He knew this?
Yeah, I said, it looked like a white hat to me. He says, but then he got louder. You got the skull with the white cap? And all I could think, oh, God, the man's deaf. After 7 years, after 10 years, he's here on the phone right here, and he can't even hear me. And I screamed in the phone, yes, I have the skull with the white hat. But then he hollered, don't holler, you're going to make me deaf. I said, well, I've been looking for you for 10 years. I thought you was deaf. You kept asking me over and over. He says, no, but you're going to make me deaf. Don't hang up. And when we convinced each other that we were not going to hang up, he said, yes, he said, I know what you have. He said, I have been looking for that skull since 1949.
How did he even know it existed?
Nick Nocerino turned out to be the world's foremost expert on these crystal skulls. And he was the founder and the director of the Society of Crystal Skulls International. And that was a research educational organization that he founded in 1944 in California and in 1945 in the state of
New Somewhere, York. Joanne, in antiquity, they must have something either written down or etched or something that explains how many they have and what they look like, I guess, huh?
Well, no, Serena knew about this skull because he was a paranormal researcher. He also worked for the CIA. Don't ask me how I got all involved with CIAs and monks and agents and DEA agents. And he was a paranormal researcher. He studied in 52 countries and on the applications of crystals and crystal skulls. Not just that, but the applications of crystals.
So he knew it existed. He didn't know where it was.
He didn't know where it was. It was in my box in the closet.
All right.
So I could hear Max say, "Thank God, woman, you finally found this person that I've been telling you about. I can get out and do my work." He said, "I thought you'd die before I'd ever get out of this box." He says, "No, you're going to stay right there." Well, then I heard about the legend. And, of course, the legend states there are 13 authentic ancient crystal skulls, the size of human skulls, and that one day they would all be rediscovered and brought together for their collective wisdom to be made available. But mankind first has to be sufficiently evolved, both morally and spiritually, so as not to abuse this great power and knowledge. It's supposed to have been handed down over thousands of years.
Do you believe all these skulls were made at the same time in the same spot, perhaps?
Well, however, is the legend true? Actually, you have to look at it. It is a legend, like the legendary Atlantis.
Of course.
You listen, a person listens to a legend, and I feel you take from that legend what you can feel is your truth, and then you go with it. So this is a legend. However, I believe that Mr. Nocerino, the legends, legends always have a start somewhere. There's many, many thousands of myths of legends that go back to the beginning of time.
All right, but there are 13 known crystal skulls right now, right?
No.
There's more?
No. Actually, there are many, many crystal skulls scattered all over the world. But these are contemporary skulls. They come out of Mexico, Germany, Hong Kong, China, Peru, Brazil.
Okay.
And they are contemporary.
All right, and we'll get into why the Smithsonian thinks yours is contemporary, too.
Right,
sort
we'll
of.
Go into that,
all right.
too. But no, unless they're researched properly. I've seen some of these skulls come out of Mexico and China, where they're beat up and chipped up and dirt rubbed in them. You'd think they're a million years old. They were just produced.
Do they look like glass? How are they made?
Well, your contemporary skulls are made, most of them come out of China and Brazil. Now, they're made with new modern lapidary equipment, diamond tools, Dremel tools. You can feel the sharpness on them.
Yeah.
They're modernly made.
Okay.
Now, Max basically is the only one. I've seen thousands of crystal skulls. There's plenty of people that pick these skulls up and go out there and dupe and con people with them everywhere from the United States to Europe. And I know who they are. But you have to have these properly researched, academic research. And in 1996, in fact, the documentary was just on a week ago, and it's been, I never know when the documentary about the crystal skulls are on. We were invited by the British Museum and the BBC to bring 7 crystal skulls there in 1996 to have them academically researched. And all of these skulls, and of course all crystal is ancient. It does not mean that all crystal is anciently carved.
Right.
Two different things.
Right.
So, of course, they listen to legends. You know, we don't believe legends. We only believe what we can prove. So what they were doing, they were looking for tool signature marks because usually all carvings leave a mark. And if they find Dremel tools, if they see, if they find where they've been carved with a grinding wheel, polishing wheels and saws, they figure they have a contemporary skull.
And some of them they found that way, right?
And most of them in the museum. The 7 that was academically researched was the 7 at the British Museum. And when they got to Max and Shauna Rao on national TV, when they talked about all the skulls, they said, "We've got this new equipment. We're going to date." And they do what they do is they put silicone cast moldings on the teeth and the brow. And that's backplated with a fine layer of gold. And those are scanned through a very powerful scanning electron microscope. And that will bring a dust that you can't see the naked eye up so they can look at it. And they went in and talked about all the skulls that was there, the Smithsonian skull, the British Museum skull, the reliquary cross skull that had a cross in it. And when they got to Max and the other ancient skull that belonged to Nick, in fact, it belonged to Nick Nocerino, who was looking for Max, they said no comment on national TV. They refused to comment.
So maybe they didn't know, but they definitely weren't going to say that it was a modern skull.
Well, what it is, no. You
yeah.
say a lot, but oftentimes you say a lot by saying nothing.
Exactly.
Tried to have that documentary pulled and couldn't.
We know in the military we used to say we cannot confirm
right.
or deny.
Right. So you say a lot by saying nothing, and they tried to pull the documentary and couldn't. That's because they really thought that I was bringing in a modern skull. Because in the pictures on Max, you cannot see the cracks and the inclusions. He looks like one piece. And when I opened up the box and they looked at all these cracks and everything, you carve crystal is somewhat brittle. On the Mohr scale of 1 to 10, it's a 7, which means it takes diamond tip tools or something harder to carve.
Does he look old?
He looks modern, actually.
Does he look battered?
He doesn't look battered. He looks perfect until you, to the pre-Columbian people and your gemologists, and they start feeling it. You can feel the little tiny irregularities to know that this is hand done.
Yeah. Okay.
And one of your top leading geologists that looked at this here a few years ago, and he may have been on your show. I know he's a leading geologist and a scientist at Boston University, Dr. Robert Schock.
He may have been. I think he was.
Yeah. He's a scientist at Boston University, a paleontologist, studies ancient Egypt, and he has been on the History Channel oftentimes. He was a man along with John Anthony West, were the two men who were given credit who redated the Sphinx. It has to do with those rings around the Sphinx.
Mm-hmm.
He kept telling them that's water erosion.
Right.
I thought it was weather.
I remember that.
Well, anyway, long story, he proved it. He was wanting to examine Max, and he did what the pre-Columbian people do. The first thing they do is they don't look at it from the front. They take it and look down up from the top down so they can look at both sides.
And he's totally solid, right?
He's all solid,
okay.
Yes. Solid as a rock.
Yeah, really.
He's solid as a rock. And they look down it, and you can see just the tiny little irregularities to see where this is hand done. And see, crystal is supposed to have structure. When you carve like a crystal ball, it has one piece. It's structured. Max has no structure. He's actually made up of five different types of layers of crystals, all growing in different directions, with cracks in it that you can put your fingernail in, which means he's not a high-impact crystal.
But he wasn't put together in pieces. He was carved out of one, right?
It was carved out of one with five different crystals growing together in different directions.
Okay.
With cracks in it. And so, which means he's not a high-impact crystal. He is a low-impact crystal where he will not take the vibration of the heat of the tools that it takes to carve. It's going to go right through the stone and split it. If you hit any number of these major inclusions that go in through him, it's going to split it. One of the major ones goes through the right optic, and if you go in there with a Dremel tool, it's all gone. That eye is even deeper. When you look down the front of it, the cheekbone's even higher. And so it has just enough, and it has a white cap on the top of the head. Now, that white cap is actually the matrix, the seed that it grew from, the rough stuff. When you see a crystal and it's got a rough on the outside, matrix.
Okay.
Well, a carver will generally carve that out and throw it away, or they put the matrix on the bottom and carve up. Whoever them was, like Schock and some geologist was looking at this, he said, decided to reverse it. And he said, actually, with the matrix at the top and going at an angle at the top of the head going through it, actually acts like a booster. It's acting like an amplifier. It amplifies all those other pieces of crystal around it. So he said, it doesn't look like the stone's been picked by accident. It looks like it's been picked by purpose and intent of the way it directs energy, and the matrix up there is boosting the energy.
Now, when you say the way it directs energy, you're a believer, as so many people are, Dr. Fred Bell especially,
uh-huh,
that crystals have the ability to possess energy, or is it just the fact of the way he was carved that somehow does this?
No, all crystal has energy.
Okay.
A big energy. So using all of our modern technologies, watches, computer, it oscillates with such perfection it runs the atomic clock. So, no, the crystal has a powerful energy, electrical field to it. But the way this is composed, the way that this is configured, this crystal, growing in different directions with different crystals, that means it's putting out energy in each one of these different crystals individually.
Can you get an electronic reading off of him?
Yeah, they do it. They do what they call an orometer, and they can. If nothing gets in its way, they can feel crystal. If it has structure, it puts off energy one direction. This puts off energy like a light globe around it.
All right, now
energy side to side and front and bottom.
Joanne, does the energy come into Max from, let's say, the universe, and then it comes out again, or is it already within the crystal?
No, it's already within the crystal.
It's radiating all the time,
right.
Basically.
And when you touch it, when you touch crystals, crystals does three things. You touch them, they take in your own personal energy, project and expand and give it back to you. We all have electrical fields in our bodies.
Yes.
The crystal has a large electrical field. We all have a low electrical charge of the brain that's measurable. If they hook you up to an EEG, which is a brain scan, and you're touching these big pieces of crystal, they can see more brainwave activity.
They can.
That's due to the fact the electrical charge of the crystal picks up on the people who are around it and touching it. It amplifies brainwaves. It can put you in altered states, and you can tap into the subconscious unconscious.
Uh-huh.
So I kind of believe, even though I was raised mainstream, I still believe in genetic memory. I think it's handed down, and that can somehow boost. It's takes people in other dimensions. It takes them. It takes them where they've. I don't know. It's unblocked energy fields from them. The writers and musicians will come and say they couldn't think. They couldn't write anymore. They couldn't do any music. They would sit in with Max. They would unblock it. And I think it's because of the way he's directing energy.
I was always told that Atlantis once had, and then it's down there at the bottom of the Atlantic, a huge crystal. And it's this crystal that causes the Bermuda Triangle and everything else, the disappearances of boats, planes. Have you heard that before?
I've heard this, yes. I've heard that. Now, you know, whether that is
who knows?
Whether that is fact, I guess we don't know unless we go down there and look.
Yeah.
But yes, I have heard that.
But
the crystal really draws, you know, it draws because it's got such a magnetic pull. But I believe that the crystal, when you touch it, you're amplifying the electrical charge in the crystal, which amplifies electromagnetic fields in and around the crystal and in and around yourself.
So the healer, when Chen was healing, he would go. He would do what? Would he touch this crystal?
He and the other monks would chant to it. They would talk Tibetan to it, and then they would touch that crystal, and then they went and touched the person. And I said they went started when I didn't know what meridians were, as people told me, because they started at the top of the head. They focused it then into the meridian and acupuncture. So I think that they were lining up. They were using the energy from that to line up energy in the body because it was working on the electrical field of the body.
Are some crystal skulls a little more mystical or powerful than others?
I think that each one of them are different. Okay.
Were they,
I don't know if anyone, because they're different. What makes Max different is the way, don't make him better, because everyone loves their crystal skull. These skulls are all over the world, your new ones. And people bond to them. They become their tools of focus. They're able to express themselves through their own tools of focus. But I believe that those are different. The program, the different, the crystal is with a new carving. And I think Max, and I've seen thousands of crystal skulls, and I've never seen another one like this one anywhere in the world. And I think, let's say this way, you got a car and you go fill it up with gasoline. You get the cheaper grade. And it still does the same thing. It's driving down the street, but it's not driving so well.
Yeah.
You come back and you fill that car up with the higher grade. And now it's just driving perfect because you got a higher grade of gasoline there. So this is a different crystal because it's giving off energy different and it's carb different, so it's programmed different.
Have you ever seen anything strange come from Max? I mean, his eyes ever light up
gosh,
or anything like that?
His eyes doesn't light up, but I have pictures of him that were the carvers in China sometimes will carve pupils in the eyes. You can't see that in him. When we take pictures of him sometimes, and sometimes on the internet, and sometimes when you take pictures of just the phone pictures, a whole face comes on him. He has pupils, and he's looking at you.
Does he have red eyes?
No, it's just pupils. He just pupils where he's just looking at. It looks like a whole face. He takes on pupils.
That's special. Stay with us, Joanne.
Okay.
We're going to come right back. We're going to get into the power of these crystal skulls now and what they mean. Later on, we'll open up the phone lines. I want you to react to the anthropologist from the Smithsonian, Jane McLaren Walsh, when we come back as well, and get your take on her believing that Max was made after 1850, and others believe Max is thousands of years old. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.